I'm an alcoholic? Yeah. All right. Hi. We have a couple announcements. First of all, I am the convention chair, and I wanted to welcome everybody who's here tonight on behalf of the entire committee. We had 700 people pre-registered before this ever even started.
God, grant me your serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And now we'll get on to our main speaker. And the name of the theme for this convention is our 12-step work. And our 12-step is carrying a message to the alcoholic still suffers. And I believe we'll hear a great message right now. We'll welcome Tom I from North Carolina.
Hi, guys. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. Nebraska. Nebraska. I can hear it a mile away. God, you couldn't hide in the desert. Like you guys said, great to be here. I've got a lot of old buddies and good friends in this group tonight, and a lot of new friends, and I'm delighted to see everybody. It's great to be back in Michigan, and almost... I really mean that now. After all, I'm leaving Sunday. It really is great to be back. This is sort of a second home. I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 41 years ago in this state, and by the amazing grace of God, I haven't had a drink since. So thank you very much, and thank you for that introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous that served well. And so I come back for many, many reasons, and when I come back, obviously, there's a flood of memories, and I get to see some familiar faces, and it's just a treat. I'm delighted to be here. Delighted to be here for the 46th Michigan State AA Convention. And I want to welcome you to this convention. I'm the visitor, but I want to welcome you anyway. I want you to know that you're welcome here. This is a convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just out of curiosity, how many people in this room tonight are attending their first Michigan State Convention? All right. All right. I lied. I stuck my hand up just to set an example, but this ain't my first. But welcome, guys. This is great to have you here. You may not know what we do at conventions. I'll just give you a quick orientation of what we do. Primarily, what we do is we hang around these meeting rooms and halls, and we talk a lot. We don't listen much, but we talk an awful lot. We drink a lot of coffee. We drink more coffee than anybody in the known world. And the worst coffee in the known world. We smoke a lot. Unfortunately, not as much as we used to. I'm from North Carolina, where we produce that stuff. But we still smoke more than anybody. And we do that. We lie a little. Not much. Not perniciously. We just sort of lie a little. We cuss some, and we talk about God, and ain't that a strange mixture, but that's exactly what we do. And if you don't believe it, you just watch us. In fact, you'll be doing it yourself in no time. You've had all the training you'll get on how to do conventions. I'll tell you just one other thing. I don't give any advice, but I'll make one suggestion. The conventions can be the greatest experience in the world. They can also be a royal pain in the neck. I mean, they can really be a downer. a convention can be one of the loneliest places in this world, because you will see an intensive level of fellowship and love and caring second to none. And if you don't watch it, you'll get right out of it and miss the whole deal. The one thing I would suggest that served me well, and I've been doing these things for a lot of years, and a thing I try to do not only at conventions but at meetings, but I would urge you particularly, you've spent your money and your time to get down here, I would implore you to be here. To be here. You know what I mean by that? You know, sometimes I go somewhere, but I ain't there. My body's there. And I'm busy trying to do the stuff I left undone back home, like I could do something about it. So I would encourage you just accept the reality. There ain't a thing you can do about whatever you left. And you can count on it, it'll be there when you get back. might even be more of it. but the best you possibly can, if you can just shut the door on that past and open the door to this experience. And try to be here. Try to meet everybody that you possibly can meet, and you'll watch the magic of a convention happen in your life, where your circle of friends truly grows and redoubles, and man, that is half the victory in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just sincerely welcome you here. We are a strange group. We a group that normally wouldn't mix. We're a group normally wouldn't even be alive. I mean, man, if you look at our history, we ain't got no business here or anywhere. We're a peculiar group. This is kind of a mixed blessed day. It's my wife's birthday. Happy birthday, my darling. That's what she said. She told me this morning through clenched teeth to have a wonderful time. I ain't sure she meant that. I was thinking about that. I tried to call her a while ago. There's no answer. She might have gone. I don't know. Nothing I can do about it. I'm going to have a good time. I'll fight that battle Sunday. Sometimes they're mixed blessings. You know, we are a peculiar group. We deal with stuff like that, and then we move on with life. It reminded me of a thing that was out in Vancouver a while back. Great place. A lot like Detroit. Well, it rains a lot. And it happened to be, my Canadian buddy Builder knows about Vancouver. It happens to be it is a wonderful place. And it, that night that I was there, I was a Friday night speaker, and it was my some anniversary of mine. And I sort of had some mixed feelings about being away from my home group on my anniversary night, and I was sort of poor mouthing about that. And those folks were so wonderful, they gave me a cake, and that was nice. And then they gave me a big book. Well, they started giving me a big book. And they told me they're going to give me a big book. So they took it. If you could just picture this. They told me they wanted me to give me that as a remembrance of the warmth of the occasion. I said, God, that's great. And so they handed it to Cliff. That was dangerous. I wouldn't hand it to Cliff. Now, I ain't no way. They handed it to the guy that was sitting there and said, sign it and pass it on. Well, all the time I was speaking, I could see that book working its way up and down the aisle. And every time I'd see one of those Canadians try to write English in that book, I would... God, she's next. My heart would just warm. You know, I said, God, that's going to be wonderful. And it was going all the way. The book was finishing about the time I was. We both went about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And one of those Canadians stole my book. Can you imagine that? Well, God knows he had to get drunk. I could just see him sitting in a bar holding that book, snickering. I want to see how he explains it when he gets back. Mixed feelings. God, I got to get busy here in a minute, but I just wanted to tell you some stuff that's on my mind. important stuff. Yeah, you need to hear this. It's a guy in my own group been out sick, came back a couple meetings ago, and he looked like death warmed over, and so we were all sort of huddled around him, sort of inquiring about his health and welcoming him back. And he said, "How you doing?" He said, "I'm doing real good. The only thing they're doing now is clearing up the cancer check." And I swear, the most cultured, refined guy in our group, I mean a true intellectual, sweet boy, said, "Cancer?" And he said, "Yeah, cancer." He said, "Dibs on that pretty red coat you got there." Dibs on the coat. Strange fellowship. He's going to give him the coat if he goes down. I don't mind getting pushed to Friday night. Didn't have get a chance to get my shoes shined. They didn't give me a holder for my name tag, so I guess I'll just sort of carry it around in my hand all weekend. Stick it up here. Well, my job is to talk about drinking and puking and stuff. Thrilling days of yesteryear. I'm glad you're here. I hope you're going to have a great weekend. It's nasty out, so just stay here and enjoy it. Our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now, and mine does too. And so I want to share with you, it's now 8:32, and I started at 8:31. I quit for long. You may want to get him back to lower the sound on this mic before this is over with. I'll tell you what I want to share with you. I don't know why, but I've learned a long time ago to follow my hunches. And I've just had it on my mind since I walked in here tonight. Didn't have it on my mind before I walked in here, but that I want to share in a little bit of stuff that I didn't intend to share. And again, just tell you how pleased I am to be here. I'm pleased to be with this bunch of speakers. They're all good friends of mine, and it's great to see them, and great to see all of you. I'm glad to see my big buddy, Harry C., who picked me up at the airport in his inimitable style. And Harry C., well, I can't say his name. Anonymity prohibits that. His maiden name was Command, though. He was... He's one of my oldest and dearest friends, and I love him dearly, and it was great to see him. Well, let me tell you what I'm here to do. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic, you know, and you know, one of the things, if you stay around here long enough, some strange stuff happens. A lot of strange stuff happens, but some really strange kind of peculiarities occur. It occurred to me a while back that when I first came into the program, I was among the youngest 2% of members in Alcoholics Anonymous. For a good number of years in AA, I was the youngest person in every meeting that I attended. I was the youngest member. I was asking about Mickey Faw, this meeting up on one floor, if you want to drop in, and I have a real affinity for young people in AA. And I guess it's because of the heritage, my own heritage. And that, you know, I was the youngest member in Alcoholics Anonymous for several years in North Carolina. And that's a wonderful place to be when you look back at it. It's a tremendously awkward place when you're in the middle of it. And now the strange irony of the thing is that I'm in the oldest 2%. If you live long enough, strange things happen. And I am very grateful to have had that cycle of events in my life. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a causation freak. But I think there's a great deal more to that illness than just me and a bottle of liquor. Yeah, sometimes we get into so much victim bashing that we overlook some of the obvious. You know, that sounds a little macho to say the only thing wrong with me is I drank too much. Well, obviously a little more than that. Yeah, I'm obviously a product of my environment. I'm a product of the interaction of myself in that environment and the people in it. And those things had a great deal to do with shaping and influencing the defects of character that drove my life in the strange direction it went. I just want to mention a couple of things. I don't know why it was on my mind, but I want to mention it. That were significant in shaping me in the kind of warped posture that I was so that I functioned like I did for so many years. And I won't elaborate on them, just mention them, but when I think back to the origin of my alcoholism, what was it that pushed me in this direction and propelled me in this direction? I think of two basic things. One had to do with my response to organized religion. I was somebody born down in the Deep South, introduced to fundamentalist Bible Belt religion, and it didn't take. For many people, it does take, and most of those folks did far better than me. But I was one for whom it didn't take, and I grew up in it with a very warped, distorted kind of notion about things spiritual. And when I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I identified myself as an atheist. I don't know that I really was, but I was. Suffice it to say, I was somebody who was totally devoid of any faith. And where there should have been a spiritual life, there was a giant hole in my soul where there should have been a core from where values form and things like that. And so atheists would come close to it. I think atheist was a little slicker word than confused, and so I adopted that. But that's a major problem. When I look back to the origin of my alcoholism, I would say that that was the foundation. Because how I dealt with that turmoil and stress and confusion was to pretend it wasn't so. And I learned early on how to bury and stuff feelings too bad to bring forward. And I lived my life in a kind of a dual existence. One existence was how I was on the inside. The other was how I acted on the outside. Fundamental to the things that resulted in alcoholism, shaped those defects of character that drove me. Second thing had to do with my immediate family, and it's just a matter of experience. It isn't a matter of causation, it's a matter of the experience and how I responded to it. My family broke up when I was 4 years old. My father didn't break up, my father deserted the family when I was 4 years old. I remember the day he left. I don't know that he told me he left. I didn't know where he was going, didn't know that he wasn't coming back, but somehow I guess I sensed that. And I remember that day sitting in the dusty yard in South Carolina watching my father walk away, and somehow I knew he wouldn't be back. Don't know why. Just an instinct, I guess. But it was a fact. I saw him two times in my life, both times disappointing, troubling experiences. And so I grew up where there should have been a father interacting in my life with an empty space there. Now, if you had asked me anything about that during my active drinking or alcoholism, or during the first 12 or 15 years or 10, at least 12 years of my recovery, if you had asked me about that, I would have drawn a blank. I would have said, there is no father, there's no big deal, there's no problem, and I would have meant that as sincerely as I was capable of meaning anything. Well, I'll let you in on a little something. You don't do that to a four-year-old child without deep, devastating damage. And I didn't know that. I really never understood that till I had some children of my own, and particularly my son. And I started to watch how my son interacted with life and how he used me in developing his life. I watched him learn how to be a functioning male by watching me. I watched him laugh at my idiosyncrasies and then adopt them as his own. I watched him learn to shave by watching me shave. Yeah, and I had never understood. I had either never stopped to think or never dared to think, I'm not sure which, about that relationship in my life. And so, you know, I guess you don't miss what you don't have, but that reminded me, and that sort of thing started to clarify me a little bit about what happened. Yeah, I didn't realize how important that man would have been in my life in terms of developing trust and closeness and intimacy with other people. Yeah, I wondered why I was such a self-centered and isolated person until I take a look at the early influences that shaped me. I wondered why I was such a deceitful person, such a dishonest person, such a person locked in denial, until I started to realize something about enough of that. You can see what I'm talking about. You know, that alcoholism was a natural for a guy set up like that. And so when I started to drink, man, I just fell in love with it. And booze for me was not an instant problem, it was an instant solution. And I loved that stuff. It was a major solution in my life. It took a miserable, self-centered, isolated, fearful, ill-confident kid and turned him into a rather confident young man. And I would have been stupid not to drink. That was the greatest solution I ever found in my life. It was the cheapest thing. And I could get a $2 bottle of moonshine and I could fix anything. Sure beats psychiatry, I'll tell you that. It was, and I just loved it. It wasn't a problem. I started drinking like it was a problem. I drank a lot, but the logic was clear. Still makes sense to me. If it does some good, do it more of it. I mean, I don't know any other kind of logic. And so that's what I did. I started drinking. I found a major solution, loved that solution, and took to it big time. And I tell you, if it had continued to work like it did, that's where I would be tonight. Yeah, I'm not here because I joined what I thought was the WCTU. I ain't here on moral grounds, any of that. Not here because this is a good cause or y'all are wonderful people. None of that even entered the picture. I'm here because I'm a guy who can't drink. If I could have continued to do that, even at the volume I was doing it, even with the trouble I was having, if I could have continued to drink with relative control, although not apparent control, I would be doing that tonight. Wouldn't it be? I drank as hard as I could for a while. Now, mine was, it looks to me like we come in two types. One is the kind who just sort of drinks for a long time and then loses the battle, falls off to the end of the pier, and he's a drunk. It takes a lot of years for some people. There are others who are basket cases from day one. And I was one of those. And these days, I think there's a lot more of my type than the other type. I mean, I don't know if the world's changing or we're just getting a better breed of drunk. I don't know. It's something, but we produce like rabbits, man. And so that was me. I just sort of took off like wildfire. And then something happened to me that was irretrievable, indelible, but invisible. I became an alcoholic. I developed alcoholism. We refer to that as crossing a line. Well, it's not in the book, but we do refer to it that way a lot, as crossing a line. And that's a good description. Now, I didn't know I crossed any line. I just know that after I got sober and looked back, I could see that I clearly went through a juncture where my drinking dramatically changed. I didn't know it at the time. I drank as much as I could before I became alcoholic. Didn't drink much more. I just had different results because something happened. I really think what happened, some people say our book doesn't define alcoholism. I think it does. I think it defines it very clearly, very specifically, as lucidly as I would ever want to hear it. And it's the foundation of my life. It's my favorite place in the whole book because it puts form to what I'm groping around with here, of what happened to change the character of my drinking. You know, I was in the book, in the third paragraph, chapter 3. Am I going too fast for y'all? I probably sound like slow motion to a bunch of Yankees, but I tell you, this is as hard as I can go because I. I'm going too fast. Me, I'm talking faster than I can think. But what the book says, and I think it describes it clearly, and God, it never made sense to me, in that third paragraph, the third chapter, it's the only thing in the book that I can say with confidence. The rest of it, I just ad-lib. It's the only thing I know. It says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Amen. Amen. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. To me, that's the exact definition of alcoholism. I don't care for any other. I've read volumes about alcoholism. I've read volumes trying to put handles on it. That defines it as clearly, as specifically as I ever want to hear it. And that's exactly what happened to me when I was 18 years old. I didn't know that, but I lost the ability to control my drinking. Is that you, Will? Well, you old gray-headed rascal.
How'd you look awful?
My good buddy from down North Carolina. It is great to see you guys. How about me? And the reason I like that definition, I guess one reason I'm particularly partial to that, is because it does clearly establish what happened. You know, it clearly puts words on it. Yeah, I when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly being a young guy, I felt a tremendous sense of discomfort inside Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I felt tremendously intimidated many times in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, it was interesting to me that when I described my drinking in my early days in Alcoholics Anonymous, I said that my serious drinking lasted 12 years. And that wasn't so. I wasn't deliberately lying. I was trying to make myself fit a little better because most of the members back then had drunk more years than I was years old. But that wasn't so. You know, my serious drinking lasted a period of 8 years. And so I guess the reason that definition is so important is that I need to understand what the heart of the issue is. And the heart of the issue is not how long I drank. Has little to do with it, as a matter of fact. My judgment. It has nothing to do with how much I drink, or at least not much. Now, I never have met many alcoholics. I never met any alcoholics who didn't drink. They all drink. But at varying levels, man, some don't drink much. My God. I drink all I could get. It doesn't have much to do with how much. It doesn't have much to do with what I drink. My drink of choice was I.W. Harper. Oh, God. I just love to see that old man of distinction standing there with that top hat and cane. And I never looked like him, but I felt like him a lot of times. I loved that. I drank everything from I.W. Harper to hydraulic brake fluid. I preferred I.W. Harper by a landslide. Neither defines my alcoholism. I.W. Harper didn't, hydraulic brake fluid didn't. By the way, I didn't adopt hydraulic brake fluid. That was a Yankee bootlegger sold me that stuff. It worked, I tell you. It locked me up tighter than a drum. That was bad stuff. That's not what alcoholism is about. It's not how much trouble I got into. Not how many times I went to jail. I went to jail more times than I can remember or care to remember. I like to think I went exactly the right number of times. Maybe one more would have been too many. Maybe one less would have been too few. It's been enough so far. So I'll settle for whatever number it was. I know alcoholics, guarantee you some sitting in this room, never been in jail. I thought at one time no self-respecting alcoholic could avoid jail. I mean, that just seemed normal. I think I went for some. In fact, hold on, the majority of alcoholics never been in jail. Do you believe that? See how many times I had my nose broke, how many cars I lost, how many jobs I lost, how many states I've been in, how many times I've been married. Those are occupational hazards of alcoholism. They just I mean, those things just happen. They're just a part of the deal. They just happen. And thank you very much. Well, anyway, you see what I'm talking about. Yeah, I like that definition. We alcoholics are men and women who've lost the ability to control our drinking. And brother, does that ever say it? Because what happened to me was that I came to a point when I was 18 years old when I could not predict my behavior if I took a drink. And if I took a drink, God only knows what would happen because I didn't. Now, I didn't realize that. And I'm going to wrap wrap my drinking into just a couple of different tracks here. One, my life, I could describe one incident, and it describes most of them in a way. I was the kind of guy, I was sort of a homing instinct guy. I always sort of had a place I drank. Nice places, usually. A couple places up in Flint that I drank an awful lot that they were very nice places, too. They were, one of them was called Reese Jones, and the other one was a State Bar. I also used to do a fair amount of drinking at a place called the Flame Show Bar on Hastings in Detroit. And a little bit down on Michigan Avenue in its better days. Pretty classy drunk, you know. I was the kind of guy who had a place where I drank regular, so they'd take care of me, I guess, if I fell out. And I my basic deal was I'd go by to have a couple drinks with a guy and almost invariably wind up drunk, closing the place, in a blind pig somewhere, God knows what all, in jail, in a burning car, who knows? I mean, just forever, forever. Wake up in the wrong state. I woke up one time, started drinking in Detroit or Flint, somewhere in here, and I came to my senses in the middle of corn country in North Dakota. I mean, God knows, man. Well, you got to be drinking to go to North Dakota. That's sick, I tell you. Well, that was the deal. That I started drinking, it would almost invariably wind up in some kind of a bizarre ending. And my response would always be the same, no matter what the circumstances. It would always be essentially the same. I would wake up, look around, try to get my senses and figure out where I was supposed to be and where I was. And then when I would realize what had happened, by whatever means, my response would always be exactly the same. Well, you've done it again. You sorry devil, you have done it again. And my basic reaction would be to put my head in my hands and say, for God's sake, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And I would answer that question never once by saying, son, you drink too much. That never, never entered the conversation. It would always be something like, you're no good. You have no discipline. You have no responsibility. You just have no character. And that's exactly what I believed. And that was my response over and over. And my life became a seemingly endless series of, the best I can describe it, failures and new starts. Failure, we call them geographics. But that's a little too esoteric for what was happening to me. That was not calculated changes. That was just one failure after another. And every time, what I failed to see is that every time I failed and started over, I settled for a little less and a little less and a little less, until finally I was living a kind of life that I would not have ever imagined would happen. I wound up living up in the city of Flint. I could tell the whole story right there. That's it. Flint got rather low rated a while back as places to live. And, you know, I took a little sort of perverse pride in that because I said, you know, I helped tear that town up. That's where I crashed and burned. I came up here like a lot of snowbirds. It's just one of my geographic deals. You know, I came up here and I started working at General Motors, and then my reputation got in front of me, and I couldn't get a job in the city of Flint. They'd hire anybody there. I mean, God knows, if you could breathe back in the 50s, they'd hire you. They send trucks to North Carolina loading people on, bring them up here to work. There I am, able-bodied, standing next door. They wouldn't hire me. And I wound up, the last year that I drank, basically living on the streets in Flint. My string ran out. And I became unemployed and unemployable in a high-volume employment city. I'd come up for air every once in a while and get some piece of a job. Had one pulling nails out of wood. Man, I'm a world beater in the making, pulling wood, nails out of wood. Got fired from that. terrible. And I'd grab a job, get some old rooming house, stay a few days, and then wander off, you know, whatever. And then, yeah, I'm confident that with no question that I would have drunk myself to death if I'd just been left unattended and gone my course. It'd be nice to tell you that one day I had enough and called for help and found it and got here, but it didn't happen that way. Many of you in this room are well aware that mine was one of those stories that was to go to the bitter end. I know that probably every alcoholic in this room has had panicky fear of doing what I did, and every Al-Anon and family member has probably had even greater fear, because any time we step out the door, disaster is prone to happen. And I was like anybody else. I knew I was capable of anything, but never believed I would ever do anything serious. And then one morning I woke up in a jail and I found out that all bad dreams ain't bad dreams. Some of them are very real nightmares. And I was in the Genesee County Jail. Didn't know why I was there. I assumed I was there for the same as always, either drunk or fighting or hustling or whatever. After I was awake a little while, a jailer came by, and I asked him when I could get out. He said, "I hope never," and walked off. And I didn't know what he was talking about. Had no clue what he was talking about. And then some of the guys in the tank told me that the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of that city and had run down and killed two people, two young folks. It's a strange thing about the human mind. It doesn't accept what it can't handle. That explains a lot of behavior to me. And that was my response. I just simply could not deal with that. I just refused to believe, gradually accepted the truth. Only time I'd ever been in jail that I wasn't scheming how to get out. I didn't want out. I was ashamed to get out. I was afraid to get out. And somebody at that jail, I don't even know who it was, but somebody, I think there was a sergeant there. He asked me some questions one day, and I think it was him that found out where my folks were and called my family down in North Carolina. And my mother made what was to be her last trip to anybody's jail to get her little boy out. It wasn't her first one, but it was to be her last one. When that dear lady died 29 years after I came in this program, it was with a heart full of gratitude for a program that had given her a son of whom she was extremely proud. I've been a busy man in Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 41 years. That everything I've ever done in this program 10 times over would be worth it for what I just said. Nothing greater. Well, I didn't know it. I really didn't know how to tell them that. So I got out on bond, knew I would not drink. The guilt was too great. I didn't think I could. Stayed sober a day and a half, walking the streets, and then, of course, I drank. From July to November of 56, drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. And then the 19th of November of 56 was what I hope and pray was my last drink. And that day I went to court to be tried on the charge of manslaughter. Entered a plea. My plea was to stand mute. And I thought, what an eloquent plea. After I got sober in my mind, what an eloquent plea. What do you say when you don't know what to say? They had to tell me what I'd done. I didn't. I couldn't tell them. I was obviously found guilty, sentenced to a max of 15 years in the state prison of Southern Michigan. I remember that day as clearly as if it were yesterday. I remember the instinctive reaction of fear that any human would have who had never gone to that step. I'd been in a lot of jails, but I knew Jackson Prison was not Disneyland. I had no illusions about that. And I'd hustle around with a lot of guys that were in and out of there. And so I had an instinctive reaction of fear, but the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. I knew it was over. Not optimism or hope, I just knew it was done. It was finished. There'd be no more. And the next day I walked into Jackson, probably the greatest day of my life, and never thought I would ever walk out of there alive. I truly did not believe and didn't care. And I'm not talking about callous disregard. I just wanted to disappear. I had no thoughts of trying to restore or regain. I just wanted to be gone and disappear. And little did I know that was to be the land of beginning again through absolutely no real planning on my part at all. A guy interviewed me one day and recommended something called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never heard of that. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never even heard anybody helping a drunk. It's a foreign concept to me. This guy recommended it, and I walked into my first meeting, Groundhog Day, 1957. Just like you walked into your first one, without a clue of what would happen. Not a clue. And I'll never forget that day. The room wasn't quite as full as this, but it was pretty full. And there we had 300 members in that group, the recovery group of Jackson Prison, and I walked in. One guy spoke to me. Thank God my first meeting wasn't like I hear a lot of people describe theirs, how they were greeted with warm, loving people, and somebody came over and hugged them, and if anybody hugged me, I'm going to do my best to knock them out if they come over. One guy spoke to me. I had an officer over the door. Iverson, yes, sir, sit down. I sat down and listened to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Much like this. They read the same stuff. The delegate for the state of Michigan was the speaker that day. A man, very shy, retiring man by the name of George Shy Walker was the speaker that day. That guy, that he didn't tell my story that day, but my life's never been the same since that day. Now, I didn't sense any change. I didn't have a clue what they were talking about. I sat there and listened to Shy Walker tell his story. Jim was showing me something in the archives that just sort of lit up my life a while ago, telling the story of how Shy and old Glenn Coffey got started doing that work. And my good friend Mel Barger wrote that, and Jim's going to get me a copy of that thing. I'm saying that publicly to put just a little heat on him so he won't forget that. But what a lifeline that guy was. You know, Shy told his story, and he was not shy. And he told that thing, and I'd never heard a drunk tell anything like that. I'd heard drunks tell stories, but not their own. And that had to be his. He couldn't have made that up. And I couldn't figure out why on earth he was telling it. That I walked out. If anybody had asked me what I'd done, I wouldn't have been able to tell them. I'd have said, God, you wouldn't believe it. They had a wild man in there. I could not imagine why anybody would get up and air their dirty laundry like that. And the amazing thing is, I went back the next week. I stayed in there 3.5 years, 42 months, and never missed a single meeting, whether it was once a week, once a day, or whatever, never missed a single meeting. Now, for a long time, it wasn't because I got religion, became converted, got committed, wanted to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I mentioned that a convention can be a lonely place, and Alcoholics Anonymous, so can a group. When you're sitting there and it ain't yours, and you're sitting there listening to people who are like you, but ain't like you no more, but you're still like you. And I guarantee you the first 8 months in Alcoholics Anonymous were as miserable as any period ever I endured in my life. Self-centered isolation with this guy was not caused by drinking, and it certainly wasn't relieved by stopping drinking. I was as self-centered and isolated here as I've ever been. And I want to tell you just a whole bunch of more stuff, but I'm going to tell you right quick. What is it that makes that stuff come apart? When I look, come together and result in a new life starting to form there. And when I look back to what was important to me, I tell you, I'll be ever grateful for the recovery group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Harry and I were talking about that today. I won't tell his story, but he and I were classmates at one time. And in the school of life. Powerful stuff happened in that group. In those years, Jackson Prison, the recovery group, was one of the finest groups of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever seen, bar none. And I'm talking about in terms of real solid effectiveness and great work with newcomers. Thank God for that group, because that was a group that was well-ordered, purposeful. It was structured to do a job, did that job very well. The inmates themselves were excellent people. And I will always be grateful for that group. I'll always be grateful to the people who walked into that institution. The reason my heart just swelled when Jim showed me that thing. Get him to show you the one about Jackson out there. It's just a great story. All of the people whose names that were mentioned in there carried the message to me. Now, the theme of this conference is, as the delegate said, this is about our 12th step. And our 12th step's about guys who walked into Jackson Prison and stuck out the right hand of fellowship to a guy named Tom Isister. Didn't know me, didn't know anything about me, didn't want to know anything about me, other than I was an alcoholic who was down big time. That's all he wanted to know. That I was a guy that was interested in, at least seemed interested in trying to hold on to something brand new. And you know, there's nothing really exotic about 12-step work. There's nothing all that romantic or technical about it. It is strange that it's the biggest chapter in our book, however. But I'll tell you what 12-step work boils down to me. And what was so important in giving this guy a desire to live again and a way to live again. It's sort of like this. Ray, if I could just borrow your hand just a minute. When I walked into the recovery group, Shy Walker didn't do this physically, but he did this spiritually. Took my hand. And then, after a while, I took Derek's hand. And that was 12-step work, where we just joined hands. And that's really the story of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we join together in this chain reaction of love and service, reaches around. That's all there is to it. It was just human beings who have suffered a similar kind of destruction, reaching out to each other. Thank God for that. And boy, when I think back to those guys that touched me and truly made a difference in my life, boy, that's special. That's special. One reason that coming back to Michigan is always special. A couple years ago, I had the great privilege of speaking at the 51st anniversary of AA over in your town in Ann Arbor. And I gave Jimmy Fondren, little guy, he must be, God, 94 years old or so, 95. Probably the most enthusiastic member of AA in Ann Arbor, Michigan. One of the guys that carried the message to me, and I had the great honor of giving him his 51-year chip. What a great thing. Great thing. So those guys who reached into my life have been and remain part of my life. Thank God for those guys who let me know that there was a way. And they weren't all, you know, the guy, it's a strange thing. I mentioned about being a young guy. I tell you this, that I really didn't feel a sense of community in alcohol. I didn't identify with people readily because I was quite young. And the first guy I ever truly identified with, I was in the program almost 2 years before I ever truly identified with one speaker. Now I identify with everybody. But then it took me 2 years to identify. And there was a guy named Lewis. I don't think I'll ever forget him. Never got to know him. I truly believe some of these Detroit hoods conned that man into coming to Jackson. I think they told him they're going on a picnic somewhere and got him in the car. He was one of them sweet things that had never been to jail. I don't think he could spell jail. He was a furniture salesman. And when he got in Jackson prison, that's the scaredest man I have ever seen. And they pushed him up to speak. And he spoke literally in a falsetto. He was so scared, his voice just squeaked. And the whole time he's talking, he's looking behind him to see if anybody's sneaking up on him. And that guy was as Mr. Clean as you've ever seen. That's the first alcoholic I ever identified. Thank God he came one time. He probably never knew why he was there. Oh, I did. And thank God he came. So that's, you know, it's about that connection. The bottom line for us is about this experience that connects. It's the powerful thing that brings us together and the spirit that welds it. That, well, I'll always be grateful for that. I'll tell you what made the difference with me, and I'm going to have to talk even faster for y'all. I tell you what, Will, I've always been a reader. I've always been an avid reader, and I was, there's no exception. We didn't have much to read back then, but I read it all. If it had an A on it, I'd read it. And it wasn't, I was all that curious. I think I was trying to find something that made an exception for me, you know, and never did find it. And so I was intellectually aware of what was going on. I was always sort of a curious guy. And I listened in the meetings and saw what was going on. And I'll tell you the thing that made the substantial change in my life. And I don't like to aggrandize anything in the program. The most important step for me is the one you're working on. They are a program of action, not a series of isolated things. But I'll tell you what was the turning point. I really didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I said I was because I hated to be the only one out of 300 that wasn't. So I'd say, yeah, me too. Yeah, but it didn't mean a thing, just a word. And then one day I went over to the meeting and a guy named Johnny Crane from Flint came over and spoke, and old Mississippi boy, and he made a 10-minute talk. Took him an hour to do it, though. He talked about 4-step. Read part about his book. Stressed the importance of writing. And I went back to my cell after the meeting. I said, okay, I'm going to do that. Sat down on that old bunk, started to write some of what I had in mind. And I wrote 2 lines of what I had in mind, which was, of course, a story of how somebody had done me in, is what I meant to write. And there was no intent whatsoever. All at once, the charade was over. I didn't mean to do a 4-step like I did it. I've had a lot of people tell me it's hard. I've watched people agonize over 4 steps. That day, I learned to be true what I hear in AA, that the average 4-step takes about 9 months and 30 minutes. That was my experience. Because I agonized over everything. And then when I got started, I couldn't have stopped if I'd wanted. My hand literally flew trying to keep up with just the race of thoughts as just a troubled young man poured out his life. And that's all it was. 3 legal pages later, I finished that. Wasn't a pretty piece of work. Wasn't fit for publication. Wasn't meant for publication. I'll tell you what it was. The most important day's work I have ever done in my entire life, that day. What happened that day that made it so important is that day I knew I was an alcoholic. Not the youngster, not the tragic case, not the different case, not the anything except I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew that I simply could not drink. I was beat. There'd been a heck of a fight, but I lost. And I knew that day I was an alcoholic. I have never doubted it 1 second since. Not 1 second. Come close to drinking a few times. But never once with the old garbage that maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. I know at the core of my being I'm an alcoholic. That day, I became a solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have never wavered in that 1 second. I've never gone to a single meeting with any mystery about why I was there. I've never gone for anybody to recruit me into action. I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. That's where I became a functioning entity in this movement. And of course that's not the end of it. I dug on in. The steps will set you free. And that's a fact. Those steps freed me in every way that matters except physically when I was locked up in that maximum custody zoo. I became a free man. In the ways that matter, I became an enthusiastic participating citizen there. I became a freshman at Michigan State University there. Somebody invented the television while I was drunk. And I woke up, and there it was. And they were piping Michigan State University to Jackson Prison. All I had to do was buy the books, pay some tuition, and I became, they didn't let me go to classes up there, but I became a member of that university as well. So I'm a double alumnus in this state. Finished 2 years there, and I came alive. Great adventures. You know, that, you know, 12-step work is for the doing. I don't care where you are. Some of the best 12-step work I've ever done were in that joint and a whole lot of other joints. What a great place, man. I don't know of any place where there's more trouble wall to wall and more alcoholics who need help than in those kind of places. And you know, I finally got out of there. It doesn't take a genius to get out of jail. It just takes time. And they were willing to let me go. I tell you one thing. You know, just to sort of set the stage for what I'm going to tell you. I'm a guy that, I'm a deeply spiritual person, but I'm a guy who practices literally the way I think it lays it out in the book for a guy like me. I have deep and abiding faith. I have a great belief. But I have a very practical kind of approach that I'm not so much concerned about forms of expression and worship. I'm worried about the living quality of spirituality in my life. When I used to hear people say that, I thought, yucko. But my God, it is the most real practical tool for living that I know. And I'm somebody, it's kind of like it says in the book, it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but keep those flat feet on the floor. Don't ever do that. And it says to pick up that simple kit of spiritual tools and take off with them. And I tell you, I've had more miracles happen in my life than seems possible. Yeah, I was, I'm somebody who has my own kind of way of understanding miracles. When I talk about miracles, you know, I'm talking about supernatural kinds of things, but they're very practical things too. To me, the best definition I've ever heard of miracles, and I'm not sure where I heard it. I might have heard me saying it. But it's the place where preparation and opportunity meet. You know, like the farmer plows the field, and he plants the seed, and God causes something to grow. That's a miracle. And the same thing in our lives, isn't it? That when I plow the field, when I do the work, and I become willing and open and humble and seek, God lets a new life grow. And God lets things happen that just defy imagination. I was recommended for special parole at Jackson Prison. And I didn't know what an honor that was till I learned that only happens once in 10,000 cases. And I wasn't asking for anything except to do my time in peace. This program made me stand out as somebody worthy of consideration. They didn't give it to me, but there is a real practical side. But it was a great, great deal. And then when I did come up on my regular time, they told me I could go if I would agree to go to North Carolina. And I told them, let me consider that. It didn't take me long to consider that. And I left here and went to North Carolina. I didn't really want to. I wanted the bright lights and the noise and the clatter and the shucking and jiving. I didn't want to go back down there to redneck country, but boy, what a great decision, because that's home now. And I've been there for many, many years, and it truly is home. And I want to tell you just a few things that happens. If you remember when I started now, I'm getting close to about 1 hour from where I started. I mean, you don't have to be totally honest. You can be close. In a general way, we tell the truth. When I hit the ground, yeah, I had a lot of things in mind, of course, and deep down, I had deep in my heart the sure knowledge that I would never go through that indignity again. And I meant that. I meant that. These many years later, I mean that just as seriously as I meant it then. Now, I didn't mean that I was too strong and willful to be brought to the ground. That wasn't even a consideration. What I meant was that I was willing to do whatever it took to find a place in this world and function there. That's what I meant. And I mean that today just as much. Well, that's what I wanted. I just wanted a place, you know, every man dreams, even folks in maximum custody and joints dream. And I had dreams like anybody, simple dreams. I wanted to be physically free. I wanted to be able to find honest work that I could just support whatever human needs I had. I wanted to have a few friends. I wanted to have an opportunity to be of some service. Because things like that. I wanted deep down to be a citizen. I'd never been a citizen anywhere. I wasn't a citizen of Flint. You know, I was a contaminator of Flint. And it's hard to do, but I did it. I was a better citizen in Jackson than I'd ever been anywhere. So those were the kinds of things. I'd yearned for a family. And so that's basically what I was when I walked out. And I went to work immediately. Got active the first day I was out and stayed that way. Still am. I 1 week after I was out. I didn't have a clue this would happen, but somebody invited me to. We had a small prison over near my house, and they invited me to go over and take a meeting to the guys. And I thought, God knows, man, I don't walk in there. They'll shut the door on me. But I went. And what a treat, eh, to walk in and to walk out. That was a real treat. To be a guest. Boy, that was super. And I just started just wild, man. I was like, wow. I was like a young goat. I just turned loose, running in all directions. And 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of that prison. What a great affirmation, huh? Can you imagine that? Yeah, here I'm in the thing, and then that, not that one, but a worse one. And then 2 months later, I'm outside sponsor, a trusted servant to go in and carry message. About the same period. And what I'm talking about are miracles that happen. And remember the definition, preparation and opportunity. Yeah, I think if you're not prepared, you won't handle it when it comes. And if you get the opportunity, if you get prepared, you don't get the opportunity, what's the point? You have preparation opportunity to produce miracles. And 2 months after I was out, about the time I became outside sponsor, my pro supervisor came to me one day. He said, Tom, you're real active. And I said, hey, yes, sir. And I thought he was going to tell me to slow down. And it concerned me because I knew I wouldn't. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't, you know, as if he didn't know. And he said, well, let me take a look at that. A couple weeks later, I got a phone call. He asked me to meet him at the Sears store. I swear it sounds like Mayberry, but it is a lot like Mayberry. And he said, meet him at the Sears store uptown. And I went up, and this story is true in every detail. My sister drove me up there. I walked up front of Sears store. I could see all the way to the back of it. My parole agent was standing back there with a man I didn't know, who turned out to be the license agent. I walked up to him. My guy introduced me to him. We chatted for a few minutes. The guy handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. He didn't. No test, written, walking, riding, nothing. I didn't even pay for it. You know that's not legal. There ain't no way you can do that. I've had people tell me I must have been well connected politically. Yeah. The sheriff of that county used to, a good friend of mine. He used to lock me up all the time. Real good connection. I tell you what it is. When God's got work for you to do, I don't care what the walls are, they're coming down. They're coming down. And I know that on the experience of my life, and God knows how many more. 5 months after I was out, Cynthia, they had a vote for DCM in my district. I barely could spell DCM. I went to Michigan State. But I won it. I wasn't even running. I wouldn't have dared run for a thing like that. I was unanimously elected. I didn't realize how easy it is to get elected. And I was deeply grateful because that meant a lot to me. Here was the guy who wondered if he'd ever have one friend. And here I was, 5 months out of a maximum custody joint, being asked to be the trusted servant for my closest folks in the world, other than my own family, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. In 12 cities. God, what a tremendous affirmation. And I wasn't a bad DCM. I never have been able to stand for delegate. I've always been so committed in some things that just didn't give me the feeling I could do a balanced job that I've not stood. But I've been DCM 4.5 times. I didn't quit halfway through. I took a half term, a guy did quit in. But that's been my deal. I feel like the DCM in perpetuity, almost. That's my function. And it's been a tremendous thing. I've been in service all of my AA life because I think that's where the lights come on, is when I get out of myself and start actively giving this program to other folks. And so that's the way I was introduced. That's the way I was taught. That's the way I practice. That's what I found that works and makes it a joy instead of hard work. Great stuff. And then 2 years after that, I was sitting in my house one day, got a phone call from the state capitol, and that'll worry anybody. I mean, even a good citizen, that'll worry. And they asked for Mr. Iverson. I got on the phone and said, Mr. Iverson, we're thinking of expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. And the first thing I said to that guy was, do you know who you're talking to? And he assured me he did. He said that they knew me better than I knew myself, and it turned out they did. And, well, you know what I said. Now, there had never been an ex-con hired in anything like that, and I knew they weren't going to start with me. But by golly, they did. They did. I never believed it would ever happen, but I was employed as a rehabilitation supervisor in the state of North Carolina, and I'm still in that business. I'm well past retirement there, but my God, why would I retire? Yeah, I do it for free, and they pay me an obscene amount of money for doing it. Why quit? I mean, that'd be stupid. I'll die one day. No, I'll hang it up someday, get an honest job. Well, yeah, obviously that meant a lot to me. And I'll tell you, it's been a marvelous career. And I got to tell you the one thing about it that just is truly astounding me. I still have trouble telling it with a straight face because it just seems so incongruous that anything. I'd been working. I never have looked it up, but it's somewhere around 7 or 8 years, something like that. And I was just a young go-getter, mud wrestling with the guys and loving every minute of it. I didn't take a vacation for 9 years. I just loved what I was doing. And one day the head of the prison system asked me to come by the office, and I went by, and he said, Tom, I'd like you to take an assignment for me. And I said, yes, sir, what? Normally he wanted me to go talk at a civic club for him or something when he was tied up. And I said, sure. And he said, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden. Well, when I got up off the floor, I said, God, boss, I don't know about that now. I don't want to be the man. I don't want to be the turnkey. I don't want to be the guy that shoot. I want to mud wrestle. I don't want to do that stuff. And I said, let me think about it. And he said, I'll give you 5 minutes. And I took the 5 minutes, went out, walked up and down the hall, prayed like a dog, went to the bathroom, prayed some more, went back in, said, okay. And for the next 20 years, that's what I did. And I basically made a career of developing new institutions and was able to do some creative work that I'm very, very, very proud of. But, thank you very much for understanding the value of that. It's obviously important. And I'm not running institutions anymore, but I'm working some statewide stuff and still having a wonderful time, and I'm more enthused than I've ever been, just like I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't go into that way. I'm not somebody who markets his infirmities. I'm not a professional ex-convict. I've never seen an advertisement for a warden that says ex-convicts preferred. That won't quite get you in the interview. Preparation and opportunity. And I didn't just fall out of a maximum custody cell at Jackson. They don't do much. And I'll assure you, when I was putting my dreams together, that wasn't one of them. I did bother to finish my education in correctional administration, and I did bother to outwork anybody I've ever seen. And because it was a labor of love. So it's been a tremendous career, obviously, and I'm still there. But that's not who I am. That's obviously very important kind of personal dimension for me. But who I am, really, I'm just an average guy. I live in a small little old town. It literally probably doesn't have many more people than this hotel holds. It's just a little old town. Smallest place I've ever lived and the very best. It's where my dream of becoming a citizen came true. And I'm a citizen there. A pretty darn good one. Been on the school board. I'm a taxpayer. A willing taxpayer. I was the only. We pay early. God, I can't believe it. That's obnoxious. I was the only guy in my community that wouldn't sign the resistance to annexation. My God, I've been outside all my life. Let me in. Shoot, I want to be there. We in too. Me and the rest of them outside won. I vote every time the polls open. I don't even know who's running half the time. I vote anyway. Because I remember when I couldn't vote. That's a very important thing to a guy like me. Hope it is to a guy like you. And so that's it. I've got a home there that the bank and I own. Now I own the overwhelming majority of that sucker. It'll be paid off in a couple of years. Can you believe that? I was a guy when I came into this program who believed that he was incapable of love, and I truly believed that because I truly believe today that that was true. Defects of character prohibit many things, like being able to feel close enough to truly make a commitment to somebody. And after 11 years of sobriety, I'd met a little girl up in Canada that's celebrating her birthday today by herself. Y'all call her and tell her it's okay. No, she supports very much what I do, and it tests it a little bit when I walk out on her birthday, but it does. She believes very much in what I do and why I do it. And so I met that little girl, and I had the beautiful experience of falling truly in love with that girl. And I learned that love really isn't something you fall in. It's something you commit to. It's a true commitment. And I had the beautiful experience of coming to love that girl and ask her to marry me with the full knowledge that I was asking her to let me be her husband. And we'll be celebrating 30 years of continuous marriage this July. And that's been a great thing. We got a couple of kids that, just like yours, are great kids. My kids, yeah, they've done well. I don't have any heartbreak story to tell you there. I mean, they acted goofy for a while. I thought they were both space cadets for a while, but they grew up in spite of us, and they've done well. I might say both of them, against my wise advice, they've done their own things. They both graduated from our university system. My daughter, over my pleading protests, went into psychology, and so she's out there in Never Never Land trying to get it all together. Now she's working with young guys with Down syndrome, and I'm immensely proud of that girl. And my son decided to go into medicine, and he's a practicing physician today up in Delaware, and the only specialty I told him to stay out of, OBGYN. And that's who I am. You know, those dreams do come true, and we have a home that's a nice place to be. And it's because of sobriety, it's because recovery makes that so. And I'm deeply grateful for that, deeply grateful. I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't used to be, I still am. I'm in the middle of participating in the starting of a brand new group. It's the best group I've ever helped start, and I'm more excited than I've ever been. The name of it is Primary Purpose, and it's an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It does the work. We call it Primary Purpose because we're there to help drunks get well, and we're going to do that. Every person in that group has a job, and that job centers around that purpose. I am deeply, deeply grateful for that, and deeply grateful that working on my 42nd year, I'm as excited in Alcoholics Anonymous as I've ever been. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous lasts as long as I use it and not one more second. And I want to stay alive in this program and dynamic and flourishing till I die. I don't want to die and keep on living. I want to keep living till I die. And this program is what makes that happen, makes it come alive. The day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in this state, in your institution, I started literally the greatest adventure that a person could imagine. And it ain't done yet. If you are not happy with where you are, if you're not on fire with it, start this weekend. Start at this convention. Hook up with people. Try to look for people that ain't with it and help them get with it. And it's amazing what happens. Guys, I wish you well. Look forward to the weekend. Thank you.